So to backtrack just a bit to the section where we're talking about doubt, do you remember that? In the second long paragraph, that the signs of times coming and going are obvious, but people do not doubt it. Although they do not doubt it, they do not understand it. Or when sentient beings doubt what they do not understand, their doubt is not firmly fixed. Because of that, their past doubts do not necessarily coincide with the present doubt, yet doubt itself is nothing but time. So doubting all kinds of things about practice and what to do for the time being, but that the presently arising doubt is itself the time being. I think we spoke about that a little, but just to refer to another section in Dogen about doubt and time. In Dogen's classical Buddha Nature, Shobogen Zobusho, that will be a topic of study next year, in the time being called now, next year. The Dogen quotes the Buddha saying, if you want to understand Buddha nature, you should intimately observe cause and effect over time. When the time is ripe, Buddha nature manifests. So it's one of the various stories Dogen quotes about Buddha nature. I think the key point here that he's going to comment on, that I'm going to bring up, is when the time is ripe, Buddha nature manifests. That's the main point for today. And then Dogen's comment is, when the time is ripe means that the time has already arrived. How can we doubt it? A time of doubting also is a time when Buddha nature is present to the self. So that's another one of these places where Dogen takes doubting, and I think we're talking here about the kind of I would say this is, we talked about different kinds of doubt. I'd say this is the kind of corrosive doubt, the doubt that how could this be the time being, or how could this time being include everything, include all practice and realization, or in this case, how could this time being be manifesting Buddha nature? And or when the time is ripe, Buddha nature manifests. And so Dogen says, the time is ripe means not some like time in the future when the conditions are just right that Buddha nature will manifest. Dogen says, when the time is ripe, it means the time has already arrived. And then says, how can we doubt it? Because we might doubt that the ripe time of Buddha nature manifesting has already arrived right now. But that time of doubting right now also is a time when Buddha nature is present to the self. So same principle as doubt is also the time being. In this case, doubt that the time is ripe right now, that doubt is also a time when Buddha nature is manifesting. In other words, Buddha nature is manifesting as the presently arising doubt, lacking nothing. Nothing extra and nothing lacking. A time of doubting is also a time when Buddha nature is present to the self. And then Dogen goes on, know that when the time is ripe means that the 12 hours of the day are not passed in vain. And I think Dogen previously brought up the 12 hours of the day here in old China. That's like the same as what we call the 24 hours. A 24-hour day was divided into 12 two-hour sections instead of 24 one-hour sections. And those 12 hours had the 12 animals of the zodiac. It's for the 12 months. The hours also had those animals and Dogen comments later on, like sheep and dogs and so on, which are like stand for different hours.
Which the time is right? What is this in?
This is in Busho. So if you wanted to look this up in Kaz's translation, it's page 237 and 238. Know that when the time is ripe means that the 12 hours of the day are not passed in vain. When the time, in quotes, when the time is, in quotes, is saying when the time has arrived. What he's saying, when the time is, of when the time is ripe, is like saying, quote, when the time has arrived. Which is just how Dogen plays with these little language things. It's kind of hard to translate. But when the time has arrived is not the arrival of Buddha nature. So I think this is a nice little section of this Buddha nature fascicle where Dogen's dealing with time, as he often weaves in time as his theme. So, and I think his understanding of time is virtually the same in all these different essays, but he says it a little differently. So when the time is, or when the time is ripe, is like saying when the time has arrived. But you could say, when the time has arrived is not the arrival of Buddha nature. In other words, Buddha nature doesn't arrive at a certain time, like there was no Buddha nature, and then it arrives at the present time. This seems to be what he's playing with here.
Or do you apply effort?
The Buddha nature.
The right kind of effort.
Yeah. Buddha nature does not arrive due to the right kind of effort, or more effort. However, we could say that Buddha nature is realized dependent on effort. But we could say, what is the Buddha nature that's realized dependent on effort? It's the realization that Buddha nature has not arrived. Can you follow that? It's the realization of Buddha nature is the realization that Buddha nature doesn't come and go and it didn't just arrive. The realization of Buddha nature is the realization that Buddha nature has always been the case, or has always been the time being.
And yet, it ripens.
Well, when the time, the original quote from the Buddha is, when the time is ripe, Buddha nature manifests. So Buddha nature doesn't ripen, but when the time is ripe, and I don't know what the ripe is.
When the time is ripe.
When the time is ripe, and then Dogen's, you know, unpacking that is saying, the time is ripe means that the time has already arrived. And what do we mean by the time has already arrived? Well, then he goes on to say, when the time has arrived is not the arrival of Buddha nature. Thus, when the time has arrived, Buddha nature is already actualized. When the time arrives, or the time is ripe, the time being manifests this moment, we see that Buddha nature is already actualized. Or we could even say, that Buddha nature was actualized from the beginning of time, but the beginning of time, according to Dogen, is this time being also. So this is very dynamic, that there's a beginningless, endless Buddha nature, and there's a beginningless, endless time being. But there's also abiding in this Dharma position of this particular moment that fully includes past and future, and the beginning of Buddha nature, the beginning of what we call time, and the end of what we call time is all present in this time being, and Buddha nature is fully manifest here and now. Thus, when the time has arrived, Buddha nature is already actualized. This principle is self-evident. Generally, there is no time when the time has not yet arrived. There is no Buddha nature that is not actualized. In other words, you know, again, this will be the, I might have mentioned already, I intend to really take up with all of you, whoever wants to, this topic of Buddha nature really thoroughly in 2012 through Dogen and other sources, but the time is already there is no time when the time has not yet arrived. There is no Buddha nature that's not actualized. Because from our point of view for this class, that's a description of the time being. Of this time being. Is that in this time being, there's no time that's not yet arrived, and there's no Buddha nature that's not actualized. And that any doubt about this is Buddha nature doubt, or doubt of the time as the time being.
Doubt as the time being.
Yeah, well, in Uji, there, you know, Dogen says, doubt itself is nothing but time, and time is nothing but being, and the time being is this present moment. So that was a little backtrack. I think we got up to the point that that I think we're down to about this fourth paragraph. Know that in this way there are myriads of forms and hundreds of grasses, all things. That's a Zen poetic way of talking about all phenomena of the world. Myriads and forms and hundreds of grasses throughout the entire earth, and yet each grass and each form itself is the entire earth, which is, again, this principle of the Dharma position that we talked about that will play out throughout this essay, that something abiding in its Dharma position is its specific manifestation right here and now that is dependent on all conditions from past, and we could even say future. It's the dependently arisen momentary expression of a particular thing. This piece of paper abiding in its Dharma position fully, as Dogen says in the Genjo Koan, abiding in its Dharma position, it fully includes past and future and is independent of past and future. And it's like, it's already, this is a, now we have a completely different piece of paper in this time being, and this one also is abiding in its totally individual Dharma position, dependent on past and future and independent of past and future. So each Dharma position is just like a flashing moment of the universe that includes everything. This is kind of a way, Dogen's way of talking about dependent co-arising, interdependent arising of all things, but not in this abstract way of like the flux of the whole universe. It is about the flux of the whole universe, but expressed in this particular location called Dharma position. And in this essay, he's saying the Dharma position is, we can also call the time being of a particular piece of paper or a three-headed, eight-armed demon or whatever. Each grass and each form itself is the entire earth. Can you kind of get the sense of how, you know, a blade of grass is the entire earth in this way that it's abiding in its Dharma position, but it's fully dependent on all the other aspects of the earth. In an inconceivable way. Dependent co-arising, even the Buddha said, is inconceivable. How it all plays out. like how that blade of grass is fully interdependent with a cloud in the, you know, thousands of miles away, but that it's all completely interconnected. But we only look at this blade of grass. We just know in this, and trust this principle of each thing abiding in its dharma position. And by through this trust, we have a much larger, expansive way of receiving whatever's happening. Because nothing's excluded, nothing's limited, nothing's so narrow in that trust. The study of this is the beginning of practice. When you're at this place, there's just one grass, there's just one form, there is understanding of form and beyond understanding of form. So literally it's like saying understanding of form and not understanding of form, but they translate it here as beyond to mean like, it doesn't mean not understanding in the realm of like ignorance. It seems to be pointing in this case to beyond understanding, like beyond our any conceptual understanding. In other words, it's inconceivable. So there's a kind of, we can have some conceivable understanding of form, and then there's this beyond understanding of form, an inconceivable being with form. There's understanding of grass and beyond understanding of grass. Since there's nothing but just this moment, the time being is all there is. And again, just this moment is this word in Japanese, imo, which means such or thus, suchness, thusness. Since there's nothing but the suchness of this moment, it could be translated as, the time being is all the time there is. Grass being, form being are both time. Each moment is all being. Each moment is the entire world. Reflect now whether any being or any world is left out of the present moment. So, in this realm of dependent co-arising, these are all different descriptions. And I think that's a great Dharma practice instruction, right? Reflect now whether any being or any world is left out of the present moment. Nothing can be excluded. Each thing is just, you know, it's... I remember when we talked about this in the Genjo Koan class, the word that kept arising for me was unique. Each thing is its unique expression, and someone pointed out that actually unique means like something like independent. Does anyone remember that discussion? Mm-hmm. I keep being tempted to say unique, but then I'm remembering that past discussion. That, unique's a little bit off. Unique, if unique means, it's like there's nothing else like this piece of paper right now. Even like this piece of paper right now is not like that one was then. I mean, it's like, not to mention the cloud 1,000 miles away. So that kind of uniqueness. But if unique means that it's not related to anything else, maybe that's one of the dictionary definitions of unique, is that it's not related to anything else. And if that's the case, then that we can't use that word. Because reflect now whether any being or any world is left out of the present moment. Yet an ordinary person who does not understand Buddha Dharma may hear the words time being this way. So now, here's in quotes, this is like this is how an ordinary person might understand this. All right, Dogen's going to criticize this view of understanding. Well,
all ordinary people.
Well, an ordinary person. For a while, I was 3 heads and 8 arms. For a while, I was an 8 or 16 foot body. This is like having crossed over rivers and climbed mountains. Even though the mountains and rivers still exist, I have already passed them and now reside in the jeweled palace and vermilion tower. Those mountains and rivers are as distant from me as heaven is from earth. And I think we could say the jeweled palace and vermilion tower sounds like having reached this culmination of enlightenment. All those struggles, crossing mountains and rivers, that I had to go through to reach this point are way behind me now. Some ordinary person might think like that. And I'm reminded of the Sandokai, right, the merging of difference and unity, where Shuto says at the end, what does he say?
Mountains and rivers block your way.
Yeah, just before that, how does it go?
How can you know the path?
Oh, yeah. If you don't understand the path, right. If you don't understand the path as it meets your eyes, how can you know the way as you walk? And the key line here is, progress is not a matter of far or near. Or in terms of the time being, we could say progress is not a matter of past and future, or even past and present. But if you're confused, then mountains and rivers block your way. I humbly say to those who study the mystery, don't waste time.
Oh, yeah.
So thinking that, and you know, as ordinary people, we think the progress of our practice is so difficult. We have to cross many mountains and rivers here. It's far away. The goal we're looking at is far away. But Shirto says, progress is not a matter of far or near. Progress in practice. It's not a matter of, like, you know, beginning and ending. Like Suzuki Roshi says, in the beginner's mind, there's many possibilities. Expert's mind, there's few. So, it's not a matter of, well, I'm just a beginner, so I've got many mountains and rivers to cross. Ultimately, from this deeper perspective, it's not a matter of far or near. And this is the same principle also as the time being, right? It's like, well, we might feel like, I'm so stuck, I can't find my way at all here. But that moment of feeling stuck is a moment of the time being. It's fully inclusive. There's nothing lacking whatsoever. You could say that's our moment of doubt as the time being. Cranky?
We were talking at group about, you know, is cranky Buddha a moment of time?
Cranky,
you know?
Cranky, yeah, cranky time being. So how do we, yeah, open to, when we're cranky, to open to that as the time being? Very hard. And then if we start to open it, then doubt can come, like, but not really. Come on now. Cranky Buddha. But there is nothing but the time being, and I think as Dogen continues to explore this, it's like, and this particular paragraph now is actually about this kind of progression of practice, and, you know, previous delusion and future enlightenment and this kind of idea. Those mountains and rivers of the, you know, of difficult struggles that had to be crossed are as distant from me as heaven is from earth. Now that I dwell in the jeweled palace and vermilion tower. So that was the view that Dogen's bringing up of ordinary people. And Dogen says, it's not that simple.
Grandmother mine.
At the time the mountains were climbed and the rivers were crossed, like right now we might feel like we're climbing a mountain, you were present. Time is not separate from you, and as you are present, time does not go away. As time is not marked by coming and going, the moment you climb the mountains is the time being right now. It's really, you know, to open to this vision is like, it's like all our past that have led up to this are actually included right here now. All our struggles are included. We could also say this is from the Yogacara point of view. This is like the storehouse consciousness that's manifesting right now is fully inclusive of all our past karmic events. They're all here right now. They're not really past. And therefore, all of that is conditions of the present, the arising time being of the presently arising Dharma position of what we call me or you or a zendo or a piece of paper. Time is not separate from you, and as you are present, time does not go away. Each one of these sentences is like really juicy. It's like it's hard not to just stay with one of them, but we just have to go on because each one of them is the time being. As time is not marked by coming and going, the moment you climb the mountains is the time being right now. If time keeps coming and going, you are the time being right now. This is the meaning of the time being. Does this time being not swallow up the moment when you climbed the mountains and the moment when you resided in the Jewel Palace and Vermilion Tower? Does it not spit them out? Or another translation, does it not vomit them out? So, a lot's going on there. Does this time being, this present all-inclusive time being, not swallow up this past moment of mm-hmm. past struggle? Mm-hmm. In other words, does it not include it, swallow it up as like all-inclusively contain it? And does it... and the moment right now, say if we're residing in the Jewel Palace right now, we think we are, does it not swallow up that moment too? And does it not also spit out the past? So, how could we interpret all-inclusiveness and also almost like including the past and then spitting out would be like manifesting those. Again, I think of the model of the storehouse consciousness is swallowing up all our past actions as these implanted as seeds. You know, every karmic activity, moment to moment, is planting these seeds in the storehouse consciousness, this inconceivable alaya, vijnana. And so it's swallowing up every experience, and then moment to moment it's also spitting out this experience. The seed sprouts, and a moment manifests, is kind of like spit out of the storehouse as like a conscious expression. The storehouse is like this vast unconscious container of all this. But what's being spit out, like our present experience right now that just got spit out of the storehouse consciousness, is it's not just randomly spit out, right? It's spit out dependent on all these seeds that have been swallowed up from the past. So this is a very dynamic thing of like every moment of time being is a swallowing of the present experience that now we call the past and spitting out the present that's now we call the past. Swallowing and spitting out. And also there's this, you know, these kind of two different directions or movements. Like giving and taking away, and there's often these two sides are brought up in Zen, like the sword that gives life and takes life, and there's coming forth and expression, and then there's letting go, and this kind of dynamic is going on too. So here's another section, another chapter of Dogen called Shobogenzo Daigo, Great Enlightenment. This is on page 297 in Kaz Tanahashi. Or let's say 296. great enlightenment. And so sometimes people say, well, Dogen doesn't talk about Satori, but this is the character. This dot go is the Chinese for Japanese of Satori. So, but Dogen interprets this. It's a wonderful chapter that we'll, I'm sure we'll take up at some point, to Dogen's really like, let's just get to the bottom of this matter that we call great enlightenment. Enlightenment, great enlightenment is actualized, and beyond enlightenment is the decisive way. In this way, enlightenment is realized and played with. Enlightenment disappears in the practice of letting go. This is the everyday activity of Buddha ancestors. Enlightenment taken up activates the 12 hours of the day. Enlightenment hurled away is activated by the 12 hours of the day. So we could see this as similar to swallowing and spitting out, taking up and hurling away. Enlightenment taken up, being swallowed, activates the 12 hours of the day, or uses the 12 hours of the day, or 24 hours, the whole day. Enlightenment hurled away is activated by the 12 hours of the day. So enlightenment is dealing with time, is dealing with the 12 hours of the day and how they're used. And so this is actually referring to this story of Zhaozhou. You may know this story, our great Chinese ancestor Zhaozhou said, this is section 28 of Zhaozhou's record. A monk asked, during the 12 hours, how is the mind put to use? Or another translation is, how does one activate the mind or use the mind during the 12 hours? Zhaozhou says, you are used by the 12 hours. I use the 12 hours. You know that one. Or you are activated by the 12 hours. I activate the 12 hours. And then Zhaozhou says, which of these times are you talking about? So I think we often hear that as like Zhaozhou saying, you deluded people are being used by time, by the 12 hours. But I, Zhaozhou, I'm consciously using the 12 hours. I'm using time in this way. It sounds like he's kind of praising self and criticizing others. But Dogen will never let that kind of thing be. So if he's referring to this, which he seems to be referring to this when he says, enlightenment taken up uses the 12 hours of the day. Enlightenment hurled away is used by the 12 hours of the day. Furthermore, leaping beyond the mechanism of time, there is twiddling with a mud ball and twiddling with spirit. So we could also say, Dogen's saying, taking up 12 hours and hurling away 12 hours are not, it's not like one is the right way and one's not the right way. Just like in the storehouse consciousness, it's not like planting seeds is of activities is not good, we should stop planting seeds and just sprout seeds, or we should just, or we should just plant seeds but don't let any sprout or something. It's just the activity. It's also, you know, actually the storehouse consciousness in Asanga's summary of the Great Vehicle, he defines it as dependent co-arising. This alaya vijnana is actually, maybe we could say like a sort of psychological version of dependent co-arising. As seen like in the karmic stream of a particular sentient being, these karmic activities are planting their seeds, and then those are giving rise to other things. That is this inconceivable dependent co-arising itself, and so activating or hurling away, one is using 12 hours and one is being used by 12 hours, it's not a matter of like using the 12 hours is the right way and being used by is like a diluted way. This is how I would understand Dogen.
Mm-hmm. Is this similar to the statement of turning the Dharma wheel or being turned?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's always these two sides, and Dogen likes to make sure that both sides are covered. Or, you know, it's like the donkey looking in the well. Well, that's only 80%. Well, how would you say it? Well, it's like the well looking at the donkey. There's these two sides, or, bringing forth ourself and all things coming forth. I mean, there Dogen does say to carry the self forward is delusion, and that myriad things coming forth is awakening. But even there, from a deeper perspective, we could say all of that is just the dependent co-arising of the time being. And sometimes there's picking up and expressing and in a more like day-to-day way. Sometimes there's coming forward strongly, expressing something. Sometimes there's letting go and like, no, just don't open my mouth at this time. Just let go. This doesn't have to be expressed. Yeah? And sometimes one's appropriate and sometimes the other is. And practice doesn't have these formulas if it's always one or the other. Yes?
So when we keep using these progressive forms of the word, of the verb, arising, coming, going, co-arising, how does that not imply a flow of time? How does that not apply that
arising?
Continuous process rather than...
Well, progressing sounds different than arising. And we're going to Dogen's going to get into this thing about flow later in the essay too. But the word arising, again, like when in that early model of time in the early Buddhist schools, they talk about like there's each experience has like an arising that's like a moment of arising, a moment of abiding, and a moment of cessation. But it's not really like arising, it's not like a gradually, slowly arising. And I think this is true also in dependent co-arising. It's not like a gradual, it's not like there's gradual dependent co-arising. It's actually, again, each thing, this book is has just dependently co-arisen in its Dharma position. And it's also dependently co-ceased. Dependently co-arisen, I think we could say, is actually shorthand for dependently co-arising and ceasing. But we just emphasize the arising part, but the arising is not like it's gradually arising and now it's opening and now it's closing. Like those were infinite moments of arising and ceasing.
So is it process?
You know, process sounds a little bit more like there is some continuous flow. And we'll get into that when he talks about time flowing, because it gets trickier there. But so far, just if we're talking about dependent co-arising, I think strictly speaking, we don't even say it's a process. It's just like a momentary snapshot called Dharma, the Dharma position of everything. It's like a snapshot of the universe. And that's one Dharma position that just arose and just ceased. And then we hurl away that snapshot.
So
we spit it out.
So we just walk independent to arisen.
Well, that kind of implies past. But in a way, we could, yeah, like, so this is a dependently co-arisen book. Sometimes we say that, yeah. I think, you know, the original Sanskrit of Samudpada, I don't know if it implies a tense or not in Sanskrit. I think it might imply, it might be, you know, because it's usually translated as arising. I think it would have a different verbal ending if it was dependently co-arisen. But we sometimes do say, yeah, this is a dependently co-arisen phenomena. But we kind of say it interchangeably, well, it's a dependently co-arising phenomena. But actually, they're not that different. They're not really different at all. if arising is just a split second, I mean, even to say split second sounds too long. It's like not even in the realm of what we think of as passage of time. It's like just a flash of lightning called arising or arisen. But it's, again, we might think it's dependently if we say this dependently co-arisen book, we may get the impression that well, it dependently co-arose and now here it is. Now it's just abiding in some kind of fixed way for a while until the pages rot or something. Like it dependently co-arose when it got made or something. But actually, we're talking about a moment-to-moment thing. Dependently co-arising is like things don't dependently co-arise and then they just hang out there for a while and then cease. It's like they dependently co-arise and almost at the very same time they're arising, they're ceasing. At least we can't perceive any space in between the arising and cessation. Does that make sense?
So any verb would be inadequate because verb implies action and this is non-action. This is moment.
Yeah, it's not really action, and yet we say arising because arising is like there is a manifestation. There is some appearance here. In other words, it's not nothing. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I think last time we talked about there's like these two sides of a coin are like dependent co-arising is one side and emptiness is the other side. And emptiness there's no arising. And actually, like the Heart Sutra, nothing's happening. There's no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue. Is one side of the coin, and then there's a dependently co-arising eye, dependently co-arising ear. And those are the ones that appear. Like, we can actually see them and use them and hear them, dependently co-arisen ones, but the empty ones actually don't appear. Or from the point of view, from the side of the coin of emptiness, nothing arises. Nothing arises, and yet dependent co-arising is about what appears to arise. Again, we ultimately dependent co-arising is actually just conventional truth. That might be a radical statement. Yeah, we might think, well, isn't just delusion, isn't like our normal way of seeing that like things are really fixed and permanent and independent, not interdependent? Isn't that the conventional truth and dependent co-arising the ultimate truth? But actually, you know, according to the Buddhist, like Nagarjuna, for example, and where they really lay out these two truths, two realities, it's that actually the world of apparent arising, the apparent co-arising, dependent co-arising, is actually just a conventional truth. Ultimate truth is that no thing arises or ceases. But those two, I say they're two sides of one coin because they're completely, like, not separate. They're not the same and not different. This is a topic I've been exploring, like, over the last week. The relationship between these two truths is very dynamic. We can't really say that they're the same or different. Yes?
when it is said that nothing arises from that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think that that was meaning that no thing arises. Because if a thing arises, then we tend to grasp onto that as being an inherent thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when something changes, the implication is that there is a thing there that gradually changes from a closed book to an open book.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, there's no book. There's just dependent arising, just manifestation. So
yeah.
That's how I think of nothing arising.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's quite what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because things apparently arise.
Yeah, they apparently arise. Mm-hmm. So we can, from the point of view of emptiness, there's no book, like, period. And from the point of view of dependent co-arising, there is this apparently arising book that appears. Sometimes we even say, like, dependently arisen mere appearances, yet they appear as like a quote-unquote book, but ultimately there's no book. And you could say, well, what about like the an actual independent, fixed, permanent book. You can say that one's today. I would understand it as that's not even really conventional truth. That's just like not truth at all. Yeah. So actually, conventional truth is somewhat in the world of like appearances. It's the best we have. Dependent co-arising's excellent view of that's the Buddha teaches of how things appear to arise. And yet, there's also, the ultimate truth that there is no book. It's like not even a dependently arisen book. There's no book. And again, like you said, that's not some mysterious thing that's completely separate from the dependently arisen book. It's just two different ways of talking.
Yes.
About the same experience. And I think people often say, well, why bother with the no book part? Let's just isn't it dependent, the fact that the book's dependently co-arisen, isn't that good enough? That's already pretty great. And it's also like, that's also a great Dharma teaching that's not the usual way we see things. It's dependently co-arisen. So why bother with the no book part? And so this is like in the Sandhi Nirmojjana Sutra, the Buddha answers that question by saying that, and I'm kind of reinterpreting a little bit, like the no book side is like the that's the object of observation for purifying a deluded mind. It's like if you just meditating on how things dependently co-arise is very good and helpful, but to completely shift this whole way of grasping like real books and stuff, we need to actually focus on, the Buddha says in this particular sutra, we need to focus on what is explicitly contradictory to the way that we like grasp a book, and that's like a no book.
On the non-grasping.
Yeah, well, it came up in the Yogacara class.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. To actually pay attention.
Yeah, you can.
To the non-grasping.
Yeah.
We also get all obsessed with the grasping.
Uh-huh. The non-grasping and the non-book. Mm-hmm. it's so shocking to hear that there's no book. It's not so shocking. This is maybe part of it too. It's like dependent co-arising is very. It's not so shocking. It's a little shocking when we first hear it. If we really open to it, maybe it's quite shocking. But it's nice. it's like, well, we still can have an appearance of a book, right? That doesn't like assault our very like being itself, right? But to say that like, you know, I'm dependently co-arising. I'm interdependent with the universe. It's great and it's very helpful. But this kind of like shock to our system is like, well, like, I'm not even, ultimately not even dependently arising, like, there's no me at all, ultimately. And again, if we got fixated on that side, then that's a problem. Because so Nagarjuna is really, like the master of, like, these two truths have to always be, like, integrated. If you, without being, you know, solidly, what does he say, like the classic verse about these, verse 10 of chapter 24 in Nagarjuna is like, in his middle way verses is like, without a strong foundation in the conventional truth of dependent co-arising, the ultimate truth cannot be realized. Mm-hmm. He says, without a strong foundation in the conventional truth or the relative truth, you could say, of dependent co-arising. Ultimate truth of no arising can't be realized. So you actually can't skip over that and just say, hey, there's no nothing. It's actually it's through dependent co-arising that we realize no arising. And then the second line of the verse is, without realizing the ultimate truth of no arising, liberation cannot be realized. So it's kind of like saying, we need to actually realize dependent co-arising and emptiness, and how they're actually not separate at all. this has been a divergence from, but actually not really a divergence. Just because the, you could say the union of dependent co-arising and emptiness, in this case, is called the time being. That is the time being. And by Dogen's emphasizing Uji, not Muji. Muji would be like,
yeah, like, this is not the Muji class.
The time, the non-time, or time no. This is, you know, or yeah, no. Muji would be like no time, and he's talking about being time. You know, mu and u are two different things. So it's about, in a way, he's emphasizing the dependent co-arising side. But emptiness is always right there. So, let us adjourn. Spit out the class.
Short but sweet.
Yes, so.
Yeah,
I think we're not quite up to, if we're dividing it exactly into sections of six or however many weeks this is. We're slipping behind in time, but fortunately, it doesn't matter because each class and each paragraph is just the time being, and however far we get, that will be however far we get, and
which is nowhere,
and each paragraph is lacking nothing, and an incomplete class series is complete in the realm of being time. So thank you for your presence and patience with the impermanent changings of health and well-being, and it's an unpredictably dependently co-arising life we live in, and the Sangha jewel, and we protect each other and walk through this impermanent realm with heart in this way. May all beings abide in their Dharma position, fully including past and future, and may D. Marie especially be at ease in her presently arising Dharma position, including all of our love. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become.